Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Ralph Compton's Trail of the Gunfighter series. Narrated by Terrence Aislefford, with performances by Danny Gavigan, Thomas Keegan, Richard Rowan, Michael John Casey, Yasmin Toison, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, Kimberly Gilbert, Jeff Allen, Scott McCormick, Dylan Lynch, Thomas Penny, James Lewis, Alexander Strain, Tim Carlin, Christopher Sheeran, Bradley Smith, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tony Nam, Patrick Bussink, Bobby Aislefford, Joe Brack, Johann Detweiler, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Nick DePinto, Drew Kopus, Alyssa Wilmoth, Nanette Savard, and Mort Shelby. Trail of the Gunfighter, Number 2, The Killing Season, Part 1. Newton, Texas, March 5th, 1873. Astride a Gruya and leading a pack horse, Nathan Stone rode in a little more than an hour before sundown. His hound, Cotton Blossom, trotted alongside. The procession passed several saloons, and that alone was enough to draw attention. Few men just off a long trail would pass up the first saloon, and it was enough of a curiosity to tempt some of the patrons away from the bar to have a look. Seemingly unaware of the spectators, Nathan reined up before the mercantile. He looped the reins of the Gruya and the lead rope of the pack horse around the hitch rail. He then paused, as though allowing the men from the saloons an opportunity to size him up before he entered the store. While he didn't wish to be recognized, he dared not seem fearful. Just a few weeks past his 26th birthday, his dark hair was well laced with gray. A dusty gray Stetson was tilted over his cold blue eyes. His polished black boots with pointed toes and undershot heels would have been the envy of any cowboy, but the Buscadero belt, with its pair of tied-down colts, said this hombre didn't earn his bacon and beans wrestling cows. His trousers were black with pinstripes, while his shirt was almost the gray of his Stetson. There was but little to liken him to a man of the range, except the red bandana around his neck and the unmistakable effect of sun and wind on his hands and face. A long sheepskin coat tied behind the cantle of his saddle suggested he might have come from the high country. He entered the mercantile, and without command, the dog remained with the horses. Nathan Stone preferred larger towns where he was less likely to be recognized, stopping only in the villages to replenish his supplies or to buy needed grain for his horses. When he left the mercantile, he purposely carried only a sack of grain under his left arm, for it was a situation he had come to expect. Men from the saloons had congregated across the dusty street, and one of them stepped forward. His right thumb was hooked under the butt of his colt. He wasn't drunk, but he'd had enough to respond to the taunts of his comrades.
Ain't you Nathan Stone the killer?
I am Nathan Stone.
Well, I'm Vern Tilton, and I think I can take you. Draw.
Tilton, I have no argument with you, and I have no reason to draw. Now back off.
By God, Vern, he's scared of you.
Damn you, you ain't gonna cheat me out of proving I'm faster than you. Pull your iron.
He jerked out his colt. He was clumsy. Nathan waited until the last second, then drew his right-hand colt. Tilton's colt blasted lead into the ground, but Nathan's slug ripped into his right shoulder. Tilton would have fallen if one of his companions hadn't caught him.
Take him and get the hell out of here. I could have killed him. I had every right. Next time, I will.
Damn, that hurts.
Make way! Move aside now!
Though it was nothing more than a village, there was a sheriff, and he arrived on the run. Taking just one look at the bleeding, swearing Tilton, he turned on Nathan.
I'm Howard Estey, sheriff of this county. Now you shuck them guns.
No. I only defended myself, and any man that disputes me is lying.
Esty turned his attention to the townsman who had begun edging away.
Speak up, damn it! Who started this?
Vern pulled iron first.
Take him to the dock and get him patched up. And you, Vern, be thanking your lucky stars you're still alive.
They drifted away, some of them casting sour looks at Nathan and Esty. The sheriff was showing his years, gray hair poking through a hole in the crown of his Stetson. He was lean, his hands, face, and neck as leathery and weather-beaten as an old saddle. The sheriff made sure Vern and his disgruntled friends were well beyond hearing.
There'll be no charges, and I'm thanking you for not salting Vern down for keeps. You'd have been within your rights. I'd not want you taking this personal, but I'd be obliged if you'd finish your business at the store and ride on.
I aim to.
After loading his goods on the saddle of the pack horse, he rode out.
Yep.
Yeah. Sheriff Esty watched him till he was out of sight. Nathan rode warily, for he didn't know where the bunch had gone who had prodded Vern Tilton into drawing. It was a town he wished to leave behind. Cotton Blossom felt the same, for he had forged on ahead. Nathan rode a good 10 miles before finding a decent place to make camp for the night. There was water from a seep that had pooled at the foot of a ridge, concealed by a heavy growth of willows. First, Nathan unsaddled his Gruya and unloaded the pack horse, allowing the weary animals to roll. Then he quickly gathered wood, knowing it would be dark before he could boil coffee and broil his bacon. But he needed the food and the hot coffee. Whatever the reason, a fire after dark, in Comanche country, could be the death of a man. Nathan chose a low place in the ground, kept the blaze small, and doused it when the coffee was hot and his rashers of bacon ready. He shared the bacon with Cotton Blossom and drank the coffee from the pot. There was little else to do except turn in for the night, so Nathan rolled in his blankets, his head on his saddle, a colt near to his hand. He could count on Cotton Blossom alerting him to any approaching danger, but weary as he was, sleep wouldn't come. His mind drifted back to the afternoon shooting, to Vern Tilton, and he recalled something Wild Bill Hickok had once told him.
When a man pulls a gun on you, always shoot to kill. Let him live, and the first chance he gets, he'll show his gratitude by shooting you in the back.
Bill was right, Cotton Blossom. Even if he fails to bushwhack me, he can always claim that my hand wasn't steady, or that I was afraid of him.
As he had done so often, Nathan allowed his mind to wander back over the years, to that bleak day in January 1866, when he had returned to his fire-ravaged home near Charlottesville, Virginia, following 2 long years as a prisoner of the Yankees in Libby Prison in Richmond. 7 renegades had murdered Nathan's mother, father, and sister. Swearing a vow of vengeance on his father's grave, Nathan had taken the trail of the killers, following it west. His constant companion had been Cotton Blossom, the only living reminder of a past that had been lost to him forever. As his vengeance trail grew temporarily cold, he paused and took up work as house dealer, bullwhacker, and other jobs that would allow him to move from place to place as he heard or read of the men he sought. Along the way, he had gained and lost friends and lovers, and due to his increasing skill with a gun, he began accumulating enemies. In St. Louis, Nathan had become involved with young Molly Tremaine, only to lose her when he had again taken up the vengeance trail. While he had never gotten over Molly, he had never tried to reclaim her, for their parting had been bitter. He had never learned that pretty Molly had died less than a year after his leaving, having given birth to his son. In Missouri, he had been romantically pursued by Yuli Prater, who disguised herself as a young man as she traveled, called herself Eli in public, and proved her ability to ride, rope, and shoot as well as a man. Behind closed doors, she proved to be skilled at more womanly arts, and since he couldn't evade her, Nathan had made the best of it. They traveled together until her death at the hands of a sniper. When his manhunt led him to New Orleans, Nathan had gone to the aid of a stranger using the name Byron Silver. Silver was employed by French Stumberg, who owned gambling houses and trafficked in white slavery. Nathan discovered that Silver was an agent of the federal government, on a mission to destroy Stumberg and his empire. When Silver was wounded, Nathan helped complete the mission and earned a good and powerful friend. In Arkansas, Nathan accepted the badge of a deputy U.S. Marshal as he waited for news of yet another of the renegades who had destroyed his family. Returning to Texas, with five men still to be found, Nathan had paused in Lexington, where he met the beautiful Viola Hayden and her father, Jesse. Viola had been set to ride her horse Daybreak in a race with odds 20-1 against her. Nathan had bet $500 on the horse, but after collecting his $10,000 winnings, he'd been forced to shoot his way out of an ambush and leave Viola behind. But they would meet again. In Lexington, Nathan had also met Texas Ranger Captain Sage Jennings, from whom he learned that two of the killers he sought had left Texas, apparently bound for Indian territory. Following, Nathan had gunned one of the men down, taking from him a hostage, a young girl named Lacey Mayfield. Together, they traveled to Denver. Nathan left her there to start a new life while he pursued his quarry to the mining town of Ciudad de Oro, where he found and destroyed another of the men on his list. Returning to Texas, Nathan found a destitute Viola Hayden working in a saloon in Austin. Her father had been murdered by the man from whom Jesse had won the $10,000 a few months before. Despite Nathan's efforts to save the desolate Viola, she'd shot the man who had killed her father and then shot herself. Returning to Colorado, Nathan had found Lacey Mayfield involved with the owner of a Denver saloon, a man Nathan had learned was the fifth of the killers on his death list. In the fight that followed, Lacey had been accidentally gunned down by the outlaw as he fired at Nathan. Nathan killed the man, but it had been a hollow victory. In Denver, Nathan had become friends with Wild Bill Hickok, and when Hickok went east to Hayes, Kansas, Nathan had ridden with him. In a Kansas City newspaper, Nathan had seen a reward dodger on Frank and Jesse James. Among the names of the men who had ridden with the infamous outlaws, Nathan had found the name of one of the killers he sought. He found the hideout of the outlaws and led a sheriff's posse to it. While Frank and Jesse had escaped, Nathan had confronted the man he had sworn to kill and had forced a shootout. It was a fair fight, but Nathan had the advantage of speed, and he walked away the victor, leaving the man where he lay. Not knowing where he might find the seventh man, Nathan took a position with the Kansas Pacific Railroad between Kansas City and Hayes. It had been his duty to repair telegraph lines torn down by Indians or outlaws and to warn train crews of damaged track. After serving with distinction for a few months, Nathan had resigned. Riding south into Indian territory, he'd been taken prisoner by the ruthless El Gato and his band of thieves and killers, who planned to turn him from prisoner to outlaw. Nathan had soon learned that the seventh and final man he sought was not among El Gato's renegades, and as he plotted his escape, he discovered that El Gato had a captive named Mary Holden, whom he planned to sell into slavery in Mexico. While El Gato conducted a raid into Kansas, Nathan had abandoned the renegades and returned to El Gato's camp, overpowering the two sentries who'd been left behind as guards, and had taken Mary south to Fort Worth, Texas. Nathan had become friends with the post commander, Captain Ferguson. The officer, assuming Mary was Nathan's wife, had assigned them a cabin. Leaving Fort Worth and riding north, Nathan Stone knew he had done the very thing he had vowed never again to do. He had become involved with a woman, more committed to her than he had ever been, but still burdened with his oath of vengeance. The last fugitive from Nathan Stone's justice, Dade Withers, rode with Texas outlaw John Wesley Hardin. Nathan and Mary had ridden to Fort Dodge and then to Hayes without finding a trace of Hardin or his gang. On their way to Abilene, they had ridden into a holdup involving a Kansas Pacific train. Nathan had been seriously wounded as he tried to help. The railroad, grateful for Nathan's daring, had paid all his medical bills and presented him with a reward. When he'd recovered, he'd been offered the task of taking a posse after the outlaws. He had declined, determined to find that seventh man on his list. He followed Hardin's and Withers' trail to Wichita, where the men had split up. Nathan trailed Withers west, knowing only that the man rode a horse with an XIT brand. Reaching Fort Dodge, Nathan and Mary had learned that a lone outlaw had robbed the mercantile at Dodge City, but afterwards had traveled less than a mile before he'd been surrounded by others riding away with the larger band. Withers had become part of Elgato's band of renegades. Nathan had agreed to pursue the outlaws on behalf of the Kansas Pacific Railroad, but learned something that stopped him in his tracks. Mary Holden was expecting his child. He set aside everything else to marry the girl and make arrangements for her future and the child's, should anything happen to him. Mary insisted on staying at Fort Dodge while Nathan and his posse had captured the band of renegades, but Elgato had learned that Mary, his former captive, was there. Elgato's men kidnapped Mary while Nathan was away from the fort and took her into the wilds of Indian Territory. Learning from a telegram that Mary had been abducted, Nathan returned to Fort Dodge. He was told that a party of soldiers had gone after Mary, only to be ambushed by Elgato's renegades. Nathan had then ridden into Indian Territory after dark and had found the outlaw camp. In the darkness of Elgato's cabin, he had killed the outlaw leader in a knife fight. But the renegades, a dozen strong, had already ravaged and murdered Mary. Grief and rage had taken control of Nathan Stone, and he had gunned down 10 of the outlaws, including Dade Withers, but had been so severely wounded he had been in danger of bleeding to death. Soldiers had found him and returned him to the fort. With his body healed, but still soul-sick, Nathan had ridden to Kansas City, where the newspapers had created for him the unwanted reputation as a fast gun, a gunfighter. The Kansas Pacific had released an etching of him, and his reputation seemed to have spread throughout the frontier. In one town after another, he'd been forced into gunfights like the one with Vern Tilton, using his gun to save his own life, each new killing adding to the deadly legend. Finally, he'd been forced to face up to the truth. He was a marked man. He had fulfilled his promise to his dead father, but it had cost him dearly. Molly Tremaine, Yulee Prater, Lacey Mayfield, poor Mary Holden Stone. Their faces seemed to have been burned into his mind with a hot iron, and he couldn't escape them. Sensing his anguish, Cotton Blossom came near. Nathan scratched the dog's ears, thankful for his faithfulness, feeling even that was more than he deserved. He lay looking at the silver stars until he finally slept. Sometime after midnight, something awakened him, and he realized it had been the rattle of dry leaves as Cotton Blossom had gotten to his feet. It was all the warning Nathan had. He rolled away from his saddle, palming a Colt. Nathan fired at the muzzle flash, once to the left and once to the right. There were no more shots. Cotton Blossom trotted toward the thicket, and Nathan followed. Taking the dead man by the ankles, he dragged him out into the clearing. The moon had risen, and in that light, Nathan had no trouble identifying the man.
Damn you, Vern Tilton! Damn you!
Lampasas, Texas, March 18, 1873. Stone had ridden halfway across Texas without being forced to resort to his deadly revolvers. Within him was the desperate hope that his dismal luck might be about to change. He had ridden all day in a cold, steady rain, and his horses plodded along with heads down. A lank and sodden Cotton Blossom looked as though he'd been skinned, and his hide stretched again over his bones. Nathan's eyes roamed the muddy, deserted main street of Lampasas. Seeing a livery, he turned his exhausted horses toward shelter.
Yeah.
The livery man came limping out.
Howdy, stranger. You reckon she's gonna rain?
Way's been threatening all day. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, my horses are as used up as I am. A double measure of grain for each of them, and there's an extra dollar for you if you'll rub them down.
Bueno, hombre. Thinking of your horses. I'll see to them.
I'm obliged. Where's the hotel?
Down the street, the way you was headed. It ain't no caravan, Sarah.
Good. All I want is a roof over my head.
After taking a room in the Colorado Hotel, Nathan and Cotton Blossom headed to the cafe. A bored cook leaned on the counter while a man sat at a back table eating a steak.
Amigo, I'm gaunt. My dog's a notch or two below that. Is he welcome?
Oh, mister, business has been so god-awful bad, I'd welcome a tribe of hungry Comanches. The dogs welcome to leftovers, and there'll be plenty. What with all this rain, I'll be closing early.
Bring me the biggest steak in the house, thick, cooked through, and sided with whatever else you got.
Oh, you got it. While it's on the fire, I'll feed the dog. He looks like he's missed a few meals.
Yeah, we both have.
Nathan Stone.
Nathan found himself face to face with Texas Ranger Captain Sage Jennings. He hadn't seen Jennings since they buried Viola Hayden in Lexington many months ago.
Well, come on back to my table.
The cook brought the coffee pot and a tin cup for Nathan. For a moment, Nathan just sipped the hot coffee, reluctant to discuss the painful past. But Jennings already knew it, minus the details. He talked of Nathan's work on behalf of the Kansas Pacific Railroad, allowing Nathan to comment if he chose. Nathan soon learned that he needed to unburden himself. So he told the sympathetic ranger all of it, up to and including the shooting in Newton a few days before.
There's no end to it, Cap. One damn fool after another. They pull their guns and I have to shoot them to keep them from shooting me. Hell, how do I escape this reputation I don't want, never wanted?
You don't. This is the killing season. And the only law is a fast gun. You, my friend, are living under a blessing and a curse. The blessing is your fast gun that's keeping you alive, while the downside is the curse of your deadly reputation. Perhaps it's time you consider my earlier suggestion and become a lawman.
Legalize my killings? I've seen what's happened to Wild Bill Hickok, and I don't want it said I'm just a killer behind a badge. I know you mean well, and I'm obliged for your concern. Now, if it's any of my business, what are you doing this far north?
I'm only a day's ride from Austin, and there's nothing I can tell you you couldn't learn in most any saloon. Texas is after a killer named Clint Barkley. He's also known as Bill Bowen, and he's brother-in-law to Merritt Harrell. Now, that won't mean a lot to you until you know something of the Harrells. The Harrell-Higgins feud has been going on for God knows how long. There's five of the Harrell boys, Benjamin, Martin, Merritt, Samuel, and Thomas. They fought together through the Civil War, and they've raised hell to a lesser degree ever since. The state of Texas has pretty well shied clear of the feud between the Harrell and the Higgins clans, but the word is out that the Harrells aim to defend Clint Barkley with their guns. And for that reason, we're expecting Clint Barkley in these parts.
And you're here to welcome him.
I wish it was that simple. The man Barkley killed was a friend of mine, and I'm only here because I raised hell for the privilege. The governor has commissioned a state police force, and I'm waiting for Captain Tom Williams and deputies to arrive from Fort Worth. I was told Williams is in charge, and I'm not to make a move unless so directed by him.
My God, that's a slap in the face, an insult. You don't aim to accept that, do you?
Yes, I do. This whole affair has been conducted with about as much secrecy as a sodbuster barn raising. Had I been in charge, I'd have ridden in, waited for Barkley to show, and taken him without going up against the Harrells.
Now you'd have to fight the Harrell clan just to get at Barkley.
Exactly. I aim to stay at the hotel, waiting for Tom Williams and his men to arrive. They're supposed to be here tomorrow.
I have no particular place to go, so maybe I'll just hang around and see how this turns out. Not that I expect you'll be needing help, of course.
No way. If I buy into this without specific orders, I'll likely be reprimanded by the governor.
When Nathan had finished his meal, he and Jennings left the cafe, returned to the hotel, and parted company for the night. Nathan let himself and Cotton Blossom into the room, locking the door behind them. The dog curled up on an oval rug beside the bed while Nathan blew out the lamp and eased himself gratefully under the blankets. More than ever, he was thankful for a roof over his head, for the wind was slamming sheets of rain against the windows. Nathan awoke and dressed before first light, aware that the rain had ceased. There was blue sky visible through patches of gray clouds. The wind was chill, but there was a hint of early spring, for occasional tufts of grass had begun to green. Cotton Blossom got up, walked to the door, and stood there wagging his tail.
Come in, Cap.
That's some dog. If he's ever the daddy of pups, I want one.
Yeah, we stayed a spell with friends in New Orleans. He ran with a couple of their female hounds, but I reckon he didn't get that involved. Anyhow, he's a mite old. He was grown when I came back from the war. and he's been with me 7 years.
All three headed to the cafe for a meal. Nathan continued the conversation they'd begun the night before.
So these newly appointed Texas lawmen arrived today. You reckon they'll come looking for you? Just take the bit in their teeth and go with it.
Well, it depends on whether or not they've been told I'm here. Unless I'm asked to take part, I aim to mind my own business.
Nathan noticed that Jennings was not wearing the famous silver star in a circle. Few rangers did when working alone, especially in hostile territory, for they were feared and respected to the extent that outlaws took no chances. Rangers were shot in the back or ambushed.
I reckon you have some new ideas to where to find this Clint Barkley.
Him being brother-in-law to Merritt Harrell, I'd reckon I'd catfoot it out to Merritt's ranch. If he wasn't there, I'd call on the rest of the Harrells until I'd rousted him out. He could be with any one of them. These feuding clans are generally so bound up with one another, when you cut one, they all bleed.
So these lawmen you're waiting for could ride into a hail of lead from 5 outfits?
Well, they could, unless they use some common sense. These Harrells know Clint Barkley has a price on his head, and a Jaybird riding in with intentions of arresting him had better come prepared to sling some lead.
There was little to distinguish the Matador Saloon from thousands of its kind on the western frontier, and the barkeep had every right to be as bored as he looked. This early in the evening, the place was as deserted as a cow camp on payday, and only one of the hanging lamps had been lighted to dispel the gloom. There were plenty of tables, but Nathan and Jennings leaned on the bar.
Beer for each of us.
Cotton Blossom crouched at Nathan's feet, his eyes on the door, for he didn't like saloons or the men who frequented them. Nathan and Jennings had been in the saloon only a few minutes when 7 riders reined up outside.
Oh, God, it's the Harrells.
Who are they?
They're trouble. There's Tom, Mark, and Sam. I ain't sure who the others are.
They'll likely be bellying up. We might as well get us a table.
Jennings led the way, Nathan and Cotton Blossom followed. The ranger purposely took a table off to the side, as near the swinging doors as possible. The 7 men trooped into the saloon, and they were a hard-bitten lot. Everyone was armed with a Colt, and each man allowed his eyes to linger long and hard on Nathan and Jennings. Cotton Blossom's hackles rose.
Bring us a bottle. Hell, make that 2 bottles. Clint's buying!
Nathan and Jennings studied the man who paid for the whiskey.
What's that damn dog growling at?
What does it matter? He's not bothering you.
The exchange ended as suddenly as it had begun when 4 riders reined up outside. Evening sun glinted off the badges they wore.
It's a law, by God!
As the 7 men drew and cocked their colts, the barkeep disappeared behind the bar. Despite the ranger's vow not to involve himself without invitation, Nathan could tell by the look in Jennings' eyes that he wasn't going to allow the foolish state policeman to walk into a trap without warning.
It's a trap! Cuidado!
Jennings upended the table. The Harrell clan started for the door, firing at Nathan and Jennings as they ran. Nathan and Jennings returned to fire, wounding 2 of the men before they reached the door. The rest fought their way to their horses and headed out. As they galloped away, the frightened barkeep crawled out from behind the bar.
God almighty, what brought that on?
From what I hear, your friends, the Harrells, are siding a man wanted by the law. I expect there are some more dead men outside.
Nathan and Jennings, followed by the fearful barkeep, stepped through the splintered bat wings. 3 of the lawmen lay dead, while the 4th sat on the edge of the porch, his head in his hands.
Oh, my God. They was gunned down like dogs.
A shame. But maybe some good will come of it. You don't send sheep after a pack of curly wolves.
Who are you, mister?
Nobody who matters. Well, it's near supper time, Nathan. Join me if you like. I am to get an early start in the morning.
You're riding back to Austin?
I am. And why don't you ride with me?
I will. I'll stay a few days, and then I aim to ride to Fort Worth and see if my old friend Captain Ferguson is still there.
Austin, Texas, March 21st, 1873. Nathan visited some of the saloons in Austin, carefully avoiding the one where young Viola Hayden had gone to the bad. The 2nd day following their arrival in the capital city, Captain Jennings invited Nathan to his office.
I have something to show you. Come on back here.
Nathan followed Jennings into a back room where the arms and ammunition was stored. From an open wooden crate, the ranger took a pair of new Colts, tossing them to Nathan butt first. Nathan caught one of the weapons in each hand.
Those are Army issue 4440 rimfires.
I've heard of them. Metallic cartridges.
Yep. Now put them aside for a minute and take a look at this.
He handed Nathan a new Winchester, still coated with grease from the factory.
The new 1873 Winchester. And it takes the same shells as the Colts.
Exactly. We got ours when the Army got theirs. The Colts and the Winchester are yours. I can spare you 400 rounds. Any trading post or sutler store should have ammunition by the time you're needing it.
I'm obliged, Cap. I'd hope to get one, eventually.
Eventually might be too late. You need them now, if for no other reason than to save your hide. The Indians have pulled out all the stops, and for the next few years, it'll be hell with the lid off. Quanah Parker's got near 700 braves. Lacking firepower, get that bunch on your trail, and you're on a one-way ride to Campo Santo.
I appreciate this.
Nathan spent the next few days in his hotel room, familiarizing himself with the new Colts. After almost 2 weeks in Austin, he felt it was time to ride on north to Fort Worth. After taking his leave of Jennings, he had loaded his pack horse and started the ride north. Half a day out of Austin, his pack horse slid a right front hoof off a ledge of rock and came up lame. He was not more than 3 or 4 miles south of Georgetown, and there was but one thing he could do. Removing the heavy pack saddle and the lead rope, he set the animal free.
I hate to leave you, amigo, but it'll take you a while to heal, if you ever do. But at least you'll have a chance.
Nathan then loaded the pack saddle atop his own saddle, securing it with rope. Leading the Gruya, he set out for Georgetown. He tried to shut out the sound of the pack horse as he left it behind. If the animal healed, it would find a home, being near Georgetown. If it didn't heal, it would become food for coyotes and vultures. He tried not to think of that grim outcome. By the time Nathan reached Georgetown, it was near dark, and his feet were killing him. He was forced to consider the possibility he might have trouble buying another horse, for this wasn't much more than a village. The liveryman was a thin old fellow with a piece of straw hung loosely between his teeth, and he eyed Nathan's overloaded Gruya curiously.
I ain't never seen that afore.
You have now. You have some place I can leave this pack saddle for a while?
Pack room, I reckon. There's rats as big as possums, though.
Well, I'll risk it for tonight. Will you unsaddle and rub down my horse? He'll need some grain, too.
Cost extra for rubbing down and for grain. Don't cost you nothing for unsaddling, though.
Well, thank God. Tomorrow I'm gonna need a pack horse. You have a horse or mule for sale?
You doggies. That's by God funny. I ain't had a horse or mule for sale since I disremember when.
Do you know of anybody with a horse or mule for sale?
Nary a horse, nary a mule.
Then unsaddle, rub down, and grain this horse.
Well, now I can't get to the saddle, what with all them fixings you got roped to it. Ye doggies, you figured that out right snappy, young fella. Now I can get to that saddle. You want to tote that load of truck to the tack room? I'll hold the door for you.
Don't strain yourself.
The hotel was a single-story affair. Nathan walked in, saddlebag over his shoulder, and cotton blossom at his heels, and paid $2 for the night's lodging.
Where's a good place to eat?
Down next to the jail. Around here, it's the only place to eat. But you'd best get your grub and get away from there. Mart Harrell and one of the Harrell hands, Jerry Scott, are in jail. We're expecting the whole hell-raising bunch of Harrells just any time.
I've heard of them. Why hasn't your sheriff just raised a posse and gone after him?
A week ago, our sheriff turned in his badge and rode out. He said there was just too damn many Harrells. They gunned down 3 lawmen over to Lampasas. Our only lawyer, A.S. Fisher, is wearing the badge until we elect another sheriff. If we can find one.
Suddenly all hell broke loose outside. Nathan started for the door.
You'd best stay off the street. It's them no-account Harrells, likely here to bust that Ken out of jail.
One of the 7 riders was carrying a sledgehammer. He advanced toward the jail. Nathan had decided this man must be Clint Barkley.
Which ones are the Harrells?
Them 2 holding back is just Harrell cowboys. The gent with the hammer is a friend of the Harrells, and I hear he's hiding out from the law. The others are Merritt, Tom, and Sam Harrell.
Barkley attacked the door of the jail with the sledge.
That's it! Do it again!
We'll show 'em!
No jail and no tin-plated sheriff's gonna get in our way.
Barkley emerged with the men he'd freed.
Put down your guns! I'm Fisher, acting sheriff!
Hell!
You want our guns? Come and get them!
Fisher came in a zigzag run, trying to reach the protection of a giant oak, but Harrell gunfire cut his legs from under him and he fell far short of his goal. Dust spurted up from the ground around him.
No! No! Don't shoot!
My God, that's Fisher's wife, and she's expecting.
The Harrells were advancing, ignoring the pleas of the woman. It was the kind of one-sided fight Nathan Stone hated. When he left the hotel, he was behind the Harrells. He drew his right-hand Colt. Clint Barkley's hat left his head.
The next one will be a mite lower. Mount up and ride.
Gun him down! It was him shot Martin, Tom, and Lynn Passes!
But Nathan had an advantage. Wounded though he was, Fisher began firing his Colt, catching the Harrells in a crossfire. Townsman then came to Fisher's aid.
Ah! God!
Nathan had the satisfaction of knocking Barkley down with a slug through his thigh. The wounded outlaw crawled toward his horse. Barkley was given a hand up behind one of the Harrells.
Get up here, Clint!
They thundered out of town, bleeding but alive. Nathan walked down the dusty street until he reached the wounded Fisher. Other men were helping Fisher to his feet while his wife wrung her hands.
Damn it, we had them boxed! Why did you invite them to ride out?
Because it was just you and me against seven of them, and you were wounded, belly down with no cover. You got gravel in your gizzard, partner. And I reckon your intentions are good. It's your judgment that's not worth a damn.
Mister, we're needing us a sheriff. The job could be yours if you want it.
Thanks, but I don't want it. I don't usually buy into somebody else's fight, but I won't allow a pack of yellow coyotes to jump a man when he's down.
Nathan turned away, returning to the hotel, where Cotton Blossom waited beside the desk clerk outside the front door.
God, it was good seeing that bunch of Harrells tuck their tails and run. Come on, I'll pay for your meal at the cafe.
Thanks, but I've had enough. I'll see you in the morning.
It was almost dark. Nathan walked around the hotel, and where grass had begun to green, he found Clint Barkley's saddled horse. The horse lifted its head, watching him.
Easy, boy.
It stood fast, and he ruffled its ears. Surprisingly enough, there was no brand. Removing the saddle, Nathan took the reins and headed for the livery.
Black horse, as of now, you belong to Nathan Stone.
When he led the black into the livery, the cantankerous old hostler just stared, silent, unbelieving.
Rub him down and grain him. I'll settle with you in the morning.
He was in no mood for questions and was gone before the nosy old liveryman could gather his wits enough to speak. Nathan arose well before first light, anxious to put Georgetown behind him. He wanted nothing more to do with the troublesome Harrells and their outlaw kin. He rode out of town, the black on a lead rope, Cotton Blossom trotting on ahead. Unless he chose to avoid Waco, he would ride right through it. He had once dealt faro there, in old Judge Prater's saloon. When the deal had gone down, he had sloped out in the middle of the night, escaping Prater's three grown daughters. But the oldest, Yuli, had followed him, becoming his companion until her tragic death in New Orleans. Nathan rode into Waco in the early afternoon. He was a good 80 miles south of Fort Worth, and it only made good sense to stay the night. Waco had grown some, sprawling out along the south bank of the Brazos. The enormous old house that had once belonged to Judge Prater was still there, and so was the saloon where Nathan had dealt faro, but its name had been changed to the Bullwhip. Nathan left his horses at the livery. Across the street was the Brazos Hotel, built during the years he'd been gone. There were two stories, and he took a room on the bottom floor. It was still early, but having little else to do, he and Cotton Blossom headed for the cafe. Next to it, however, was a newspaper office, and Nathan was intrigued by its hanging wooden sign. Either as a joke or as a reflection of the town's intellect, someone had painted a single word in large letters: newspaper. Inside the door, Nathan confronted a young man about his own age. printer's ink streaking his face and a question in his eyes, he looked up from his typesetting.
I'll take a copy of your latest.
My God, what's that?
I take it you don't see a lot of cash money.
You take it right. It's mostly turnips, potatoes, onions, corn, and chicken on the hoof. I'm Andy Partain. You are?
Just passing through. I was attracted by your sign.
I decided the Chronicle was a bit highfalutin for these parts. Nobody seemed to know what a Chronicle was.
Nathan took the four-page paper and departed before Partain was able to come up with some bothersome questions. Nathan and Cotton Blossom entered the cafe. It being early, there would be fewer people to wonder who he was, and it was easier getting the cook to feed Cotton Blossom if the place wasn't too crowded. Taking a back table, Nathan read the newspaper while he waited for his food. There was a fair account of the fight in Lampasas where the trio of lawmen had been gunned down by Clint Barkley and the Harrells. Nathan found little else to interest him in the skimpy newspaper. By the time his steak was ready, a number of other men had filed into the cafe. One of them was Andy Partain, and he immediately headed for Nathan's table.
Nathan Stone. I knew I heard of you. It was you who gunned down that band of outlaws in Indian Territory last year. You brought El Gato and his renegades to justice.
It was a bad moment, and Nathan could have cheerfully strangled the young editor. Men at other tables had forgotten their food and were openly staring. Two men looked at each other, their eyes hard and cold. They well remembered the night El Gato had died, when only they had escaped a vengeful Nathan Stone.
Partain, I did what needed doing, and there's been more than enough said about it. Leave it alone.
Sorry. It was in all the papers, but none of it in your own words. I thought you might want to add something.
You thought wrong.
Oh.
Nathan finished his meal, and when he left the cafe, the eyes of every man were upon him. They watched him enter the hotel across the street, two of the observers paying particular attention. He would be staying the night, and his fast gun wouldn't matter, for darkness was an equalizer. Locking the door of his hotel room behind him, Nathan shucked his hat, his gun belt, and his boots. He stretched out on the bed, staring at the fly-specked ceiling. Cotton Blossom sat on the rug beside the bed, his eyes on Nathan. Finally, Nathan sat up.
Damn it, Cotton Blossom, it's too early to hole up for the night.
The last rays of the setting sun crept through the window, dappling the wall with a patchwork of gold. Nathan dragged on his boots, strapped on his Colts, and reached for his hat. If there were men determined to challenge his fast draw, then so be it. He was damned if he'd hide behind closed doors, imprisoning himself behind walls of intimidation erected by his reluctance to use his guns. He was fed up with damn fools seeking to gain reputation at his expense. Much of his trouble, Nathan conceded, was a direct result of his love for poker. Inevitably, that kept him in the saloons, among the hellraisers who frequented them. But what else was a man to do with time on his hands? He left his room, bound for the Bullwhip Saloon. Even at so early an hour, business was good. All the hanging lamps were lighted, and already a smoky haze had begun to halo them. Most of the men were serious drinkers, gathered two or three to a table, bottles and glasses before them. A man who gambled, however, was more cautious, drinking little or not at all. Setting himself a limit of three beers, Nathan waited. Halfway through the third beer, a trio came in and approached the bar.
Bottle, three glasses, and a deck, barkeep.
Any objection if I sit in?
Five-card stud, table stakes, no IOUs.
My kind of game.
Nathan followed them to a table beneath one of the hanging lamps. Cotton Blossom crouched behind him, not trusting any of these strangers. Nathan observed his companions as they served themselves from the bottle. They were armed, dressed in range clothes, and might have been riders for the same outfit. The game opened with a dollar bet, and by the fourth hand, his companions had emptied the bottle and were working on a second one. Losing the fourth hand, Nathan withdrew from the game. Once Cotton Blossom was sure they were leaving the saloon, he wasted no time heading for the door. Nathan tilted the brim of his hat over his eyes and stepped out into the night. Lessening the time he'd be outlined in the light from the saloon, he stepped quickly aside, but not quickly enough. A slug ripped through Nathan's left arm above the elbow, and he was thrown against the wall of the saloon. Men boiled out of the saloon to find Nathan thumbing fresh cartridges into his Colt.
What in the hell's going on out here?
The bushwhacker cut down on me and I shot back.
I'm Sheriff Lomax. Do you know who shot you or why?
No, on both counts. I stepped out the door and he fired from across the street. I fired at the muzzle flash.
Elmont, guide this gent to Doc Melton's place. Barkeep, fetch me a lamp. The rest of you go back to whatever you were doing.
Nathan followed Elmont to a house two blocks east of the saloon.
Doc, this feller was winged in an ambush. Sheriff Lomax sent him to you for patching up.
Dr. Melton examined Nathan's wound.
You're lucky. It missed the bone.
He was applying a bandage when Sheriff Lomax arrived.
You nailed the hombre that done the shooting. Hit him twice. He's been laid out over at Potter's Cabinet Shop. I'd be obliged if you'd go by and have a look at him.
The dead man was laid out on an old door, supported by a pair of sawhorses. Potter removed a dirty sheet from the corpse.
Mighty fine shooting in the dark. You the gent that got him?
Yes.
Nobody what's looked at him knows him, Sheriff.
Well, I don't know him either, Sheriff. Maybe without the beard.
He wasn't alone. The second man lit out. And it's safe to say he's here in town somewhere. What do you aim to do for the rest of the night?
Return to the hotel and stay there. And unless there's a need for me to stay, I'll be riding out in the morning.
No reason I could think of. But ride with an eye to your back trail.
Thanks. I aim to.
For a long time, Nathan lay awake. While his wound pained him, sleep was driven away by a realization that tonight's shooting had forced him to consider. For the better part of 7 years, he had been the hunter, seeking men he had sentenced to die. For almost a year now, he had concerned himself with the glory seekers who wanted only to test his fast gun. Now it seemed they might be the least of his problems, as he became the hunted. How many of the men he had slain had family or friends who would consider it justice done if Nathan Stone was shot dead? He arose at first light, his left arm and shoulder stiff and sore. He had a difficult time pulling on his boots, and he didn't need a doctor to tell him he had a fever. He must have some whiskey, and that meant remaining in town until the saloons opened. After breakfast, Nathan's impatience got the best of him. He turned in his key and got the horses from the livery and rode out. The lead rope of the pack horse dallied around his saddle horn. Yeah. To his relief, he found the Bullwhip Saloon open and the barkeep alone.
Quart of whiskey, barkeep.
There you go. Glad you got the sidewinder that gave you that hurt arm.
Nathan mounted the Gruya and rode north. Waiting until he was out of town, he drew the cork with his teeth and took a long pull from the bottle. The Gruya sneaked its head around and looked at him.
God, awful stuff, horse. Nobody but a damn fool would drink it for anything but medicine.
Having ridden only a few miles, Nathan became dizzy, and putting the back of his hand to his forehead told him his fever had worsened. He took another long pull from the whiskey bottle. The sun was almost noon high, and in his feverish state, he had no idea how far he'd ridden. He'd killed half the bottle of whiskey, and he dared not drink any more, lest he become too drunk to stay in the saddle. He rode on, the westering sun seeming oppressively hot. Finally, clouds drifted over the sun. A light breeze touched Nathan's brow with cooling fingers. Relieved, he put the back of his hand to his forehead, feeling beads of sweat. His fever had broken. Kicking the Gruya into a trot, he rode on toward Fort Worth.